In regards to power and authority, why is it difficult and important to scrutinize and challenge the legitimacy of the psychiatric gospel, the DSM?
Because such a vast amount of harm is done as a result of people believing in the gospel. I cannot tell you how many people I have heard from whose lives have been devastated in an astonishing variety of ways, and I keep hearing about more and more. And it's all based on what happens in psychiatric diagnosis, because you can't put somebody on psychiatric medication unless you've given them a psychiatric diagnosis. You can't prescribe electroshock unless you've given them a diagnosis. You can't have them committed against their will unless you've given them a psychiatric diagnosis.
As a longtime specialist in teaching and writing about research methods, you were able to assess and monitor the extent to which scientific methods and evidence are disregarded as the DSM is developed and revised. Now, in 1985, you became quite involved with the DSM executive as they were preparing a new edition of the manual. Now, in particular, you were opposing the proposals for self-defeating personality disorder, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, and paraphilic rapism. Could you describe what these so-called disorders entail?
Oh, yes, and I'm so glad you called them so-called disorders, because a lot of people think if it's in the DSM, it must be a real entity and it must be a mental illness. Well, let's take them one at a time. Actually, self-defeating personality disorder's initial name was masochistic personality disorder, and it was pretty much what it says, that you must enjoy suffering. That was the sweeping implication of it. The criteria were things like puts other people's needs ahead of their own, settles for inferior choices when clearly better ones are available. And there were two problems with that. One was that in many ways the criteria for masochistic personality disorder were just a description of traditional female socialization. So you'd better put other people's needs ahead of your own, or else people will say you're a bad woman and you're unnatural, and they will reject you. But if you do put people's needs ahead of your own, well, then it turns out you're mentally ill. The other problem with that category was that people who've been abused especially will put everyone's needs ahead of their own and make inferior choices when other ones that are clearly better in other people's eyes would be available to them. And so it was a way of victim blaming for people who had been abused. The masochistic personality disorder was a perfect catch-22, is what it created, because if you follow the criteria for a good woman, then that fits the criteria for masochistic personality disorder. If you're going to be a good woman, you must be mentally ill. But if you don't fit those criteria, then you suffer in other ways. Then the second category that you mentioned, two guys made it up on a fishing trip. And I know that sounds like a joke, and it's apparently literally true. One of the people who was a big shot in the DSM, and then the guy who was at the very top of it, Robert Spitzer, they made up premenstrual dysphoric disorder. And they took care to say, we're not talking about PMS, about chocolate cravings and bloating and breast tenderness. We're talking about a mental illness with serious mood problems. Now, there were several difficulties with this, one of which is when you read their description of what you have to do in order to be diagnosable with PMDD, they put in there food cravings, bloating, breast tenderness, all these things that you have to say, why are they in a psychiatric manual? And you only have to have one mood problem in order to meet the criteria for premenstrual dysphoric disorder. So what they're doing is they're taking some physical discomforts or problems and they're saying, well, let's just pair those with something that only women can have and one mood problem, and then we'll call it a mental illness. And then if you look at the mood problem, it could be one of four things. Marked, that was the word, their word, marked anxiety, or marked irritability, depression, or lability, emotional lability, changeability. And you have to ask then, Who decides if it's marked lability and marked depression? Well, it's whatever therapist happens to be looking at you, or whatever OBGYN or general practitioner is looking at you. And so it's highly subjective. The problem with this then is that, of course, lots of women get bloating and breast tenderness and food cravings right before their periods. And that means that any woman who has any of those problems and then sees herself as not a perfect woman, that is, not always serene and sweet and loving, is going to say, oh my God, I must be mentally ill. And lots of women have done just that. And then they go to their doctors, and after seeing ads for the drugs for PMDD on TV, these ads show women who look like they're nuts, like they're wild, like they're complete witches, trying to get a grocery cart out of, you know, one that it's stuck to in front of it. And then you hear this voiceover that says, you may think you have PMS, but you really have PMDD. And then, you know, a woman looks there and she says, oh my God, that's what's wrong with me. And I don't want to be that way. I want to be a good woman. The pill will make me into the woman I want to be. And so they go to doctors and they ask for that to be prescribed. And research has shown that about 85% of people who go to a doctor and ask for a prescription by name walk out with a prescription for that drug. And the pharmaceutical companies say, isn't that wonderful? What we're doing through our advertising is we're teaching consumers to take control of their treatment. But of course, what they're teaching them is to listen to the propaganda and go ask for the drugs that promise the moon. So that was part of the problem with premenstrual dysphoric disorder, with making that a mental illness. And it was just another way of pathologizing women in general. In fact, they have long had a psychiatric category for, I think it used to be called involutional melancholia. Doesn't that sound awful?
What's that?
Empty nest syndrome, right? It was when you were menopausal and your children were leaving the nest, then if you were sad, involutional melancholia, no such thing as normal sadness. So now you've got premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Now the latest thing is they're talking about perimenopausal psychiatric disorders. And so it's, you know, it's covered from your first period right through until you die. You're going to qualify, if you're a woman, for one of these psychiatric disorders. And mark my words, pretty soon we're going to have premenarchial some kind of psychiatric illness for which you need hormones. And, you know, it's just a way of pathologizing women. Now, those first two, the masochistic personality disorder, which was renamed self-defeating personality disorder, and premenstrual dysphoric disorder, got into the edition of the DSM for which they were first proposed. The third one, though, paraphilic rapism, what that was, briefly, was somebody who was obsessed with thoughts of rape or had committed rape. Now, you can imagine that that would be an automatic mitigating factor. All you have to do is say, yes, you're in court here, you're up for committing rape and or attempted rape. And then the attempted rapist or the rapist says, well, that's because I have a mental illness, so that's a mitigating factor. So I get a reduced sentence, or I just get ordered into psychotherapy. So that was really appalling. Well, fortunately, an assistant attorney general of the United States, who happened to be a woman, sent a letter to the American Psychiatric Association saying, if you put this in your diagnostic manual, we will bring lawsuits. This is the government saying it was going to bring lawsuits against the American Psychiatric Association. I don't think any such thing has been proposed since then. Not only not that category, but I don't think the government is going after the APA, even though they should be. One other thing I should mention about self-defeating personality disorder is, though, it went into the 1987 edition of the DSM. Supposedly everything in one edition of the DSM is up for discussion before the next one comes out. Should we keep it in? Should we leave it out? And they had said they were discussing whether to keep this in. And what happened was there's this wonderful, brave woman psychiatrist named Dr. Margaret Jensvold. And to shorten a very long story, she was filing a lawsuit for sex discrimination and sexual harassment. And the psychiatrist who was seeing her had diagnosed her as having self-defeating personality disorder, the implication being, well, even if she was treated this way, she brought it on herself. She needed for it to happen. Well, she decided that if she was going to have to go through this trial, she was going to do as much as she could to help other women. And so she and Ginger Breggin got together, and they wrote a press release, and they got in touch with the media, and they said that this was going to be the tailhook of the mental health establishment, tailhook being that big scandal about sexual harassment in the military in the United States. And it was found out shortly before the trial started that some of the major media in the United States were going to cover it. And I believe the Journal of the American Medical Association was going to cover it. I think Lancet from Britain was going to send a reporter. And lo and behold, the case was settled before it went to court. At that time, the American Psychiatric Association made an announcement. And let me just give you a little bit of history here. I was on the committee that was supposed to decide, are we going to keep it in? And of course, I thought, no, it shouldn't have gone in the first place. Well, the rest of the committee, I'd been getting their memos, and they were just talking about tweaking a word here and there. There was no discussion of, shall we take it out for the next edition? When the Jensvold case happened, they suddenly announced publicly that self-defeating personality disorder was not going in the next edition of the DSM. And they said the reason was because the data from the scientific studies didn't warrant it. That was an out-and-out lie. And later on, I found an internal memo that proved that that was a political decision, not a scientific decision.
With that said, the DSM purports to be a scientific tome.
Yes.
How do diagnoses get in there?
Far from scientific. I should tell you that I used to teach the DSM as an advocate. When I was teaching graduate students at OISE, mm-hmm. I used to say, this is this wonderful, scientifically grounded psychiatric diagnostic document. Isn't it great? Because that's what my teachers had taught me, and I didn't have any reason to think otherwise. And so it was only when I was on two of the committees to write DSM-4 that I saw it could not be further from scientific. They seem to operate on a couple of principles. One is, almost anything that gets proposed as a new category gets in, as far as I can tell, because more money, more territory for them. And secondly, if somebody proposes a category and you really don't like them or the group they belong to, then you really stop and think twice. And the fact is that hardly anybody proposes categories that they decide not to include. We did, but mostly they'll put just about anything in. And here's what the process is supposed to look like. There's what they say happens, and then there's what really happens. They have this very hierarchical structure. They have a committee and subcommittees and work groups and so on. And each of these is supposed to have members who are specialists in the area. So you've got the group that works on anxiety disorders, and you've got the group that works on depression, and the group for personality disorders. And then they're supposed to look at the research, evaluate it critically, honestly, which virtually never happens, and then make a report with a recommendation. What categories should go in, stay in, come out, and so on. What really happens is that very little attention is paid to the science. If the science suits their purposes, then they will talk about it. If it doesn't, they will ignore it, distort it, or lie about it. And what I saw happening in the case of premenstrual dysphoric disorder was that when some of us were saying it should not go in the next edition of the DSM, I was the only person on that committee for the DSM that thought that. The rest of the committee, by the way, they wouldn't tell me when their meetings were, they wouldn't tell me by when they needed input from me, but I would send stuff anyway, and they had me on their mailing list, so I would see what they had decided when I wasn't there. But what they did was they, without my assistance, wrote a 125-page review of the research. And they concluded, interestingly enough, they said, you know, we've reviewed in here more than 400 published research articles, and they had. And they said, but very few of those have any bearing on the question of whether there's a premenstrual mental illness. Most of them had to do with, do people get bloating and breast tenderness and that sort of thing, but not with a premenstrual mental illness. So they did acknowledge that. And they said, quite correctly, they said in their summary that the few studies that were relevant to that question were very preliminary and had many methodological problems. Now you read that and you think, oh, well, first of all, isn't it nice that they were honest? And secondly, of course they're going to recommend that PMDD come out of the next edition of the DSM. That's not what they did. They told the higher-ups in the hierarchy, we couldn't reach a consensus. Now, listen for the scientific process in what follows. So then what happens? Well, Dr. Alan Francis, who was the king for DSM-IV, he appointed two other people. He announced publicly, I'm appointing two other people to decide what should happen, because the committee couldn't reach a consensus. Now, journalists were calling me and saying, now, who are those people he appointed? And I was saying, I have no idea. I said, I suggest you ask him. Journalists were calling me back. We asked him. He won't tell us. So I called him, and I said, Alan, who are these people? Because supposedly they had appointed the experts on premenstrual matters to the committee, and the committee couldn't reach a consensus. So who are those two people? And he said, and I quote, and I wrote it down because I thought, I'm not going to believe this if I don't write it down. He said, I'm not going to tell you because then they would be deluged with questions. And I thought, well, now this is Alan Francis. He's the man who appointed me to these committees, and he did so. He convinced me to agree because he said, this time for this edition, we're going to base the decisions on the science, and this time we want an open, honest debate. Well, so much for an open, honest debate. I'm not going to tell you who these experts are. So I kept telling journalists to call Dr. Francis and ask him. He finally told. And one of them was Nancy Andreasen, who's been very thick with a lot of the DSM heads for many, many years. And she has said publicly that she believes all emotional problems have a brain basis. They're all based in a problematic brain. And then a guy named A. John Rush, whose specialty is depression. Now, guess what those two folks recommended? Neither one was an expert on premenstrual matters. They recommended, first of all, that PMDD go in the next edition of the DSM, surprise, surprise, and they recommended that it be listed under depression, Dr. Rush's specialty. And that was the case even though you don't have to be depressed to fit the description for PMDD. So that's how political all of that is.
And how did you and others challenge that?
Not effectively. You know, we keep ranting and raving and writing papers and giving talks and trying to do public education, trying to speak to the media. And we are having some effect in doing that, but none of that has come near to touching what they actually do.
You were involved with presenting delusional dominating personality disorder to identify consequences of rigid masculine socialization. Tell us about that.
I'd been going around, this is a Canadian story actually, I had been going around giving talks and saying, you know, they've got self-defeating personality disorder, which is just traditional female socialization, but they don't have the male equivalent. They don't have John Wayne personality disorder or macho personality disorder, and people would laugh and they'd get the point. Well, Margaret Eichler, who's at OAC and she's at the U of T now, brilliant feminist sociologist, heard me give one of those talks and said afterward, let's do it. So we got together and using the DSM format, you know, have a list of criteria and so on, we made up delusional dominating personality disorder, which is just traditional male socialization, and we submitted it. Margaret said, okay, now we send it to the DSM people. And I said, oh, Margaret, there's no way they're going to include that. And she said, well, of course they won't, but we save the correspondence. And I remember getting chills up my spine. I thought, oh, something's going to happen. And that became the basis for my book, They Say You're Crazy, because a lot of it is about my time with the DSM guys and quotations from letters that we wrote to each other. And it really did reveal quite a lot about how they work.
How did the APA respond to that, to DDPD?
Well, we sent in the proposal, and I got a letter from Alan Francis, the head of DSM, and he said, essentially, how serious are you? And we wrote back and said, very. And then we didn't hear any more, and then I wrote and I said, now, because I'm on two DSM committees, I'm aware that when there's a proposal for a new category, it's assigned to one of your groups. And to which group should I be sending communications? And I believe he said the personality, there was a personality disorders group, but I never could get them to answer. And what one of my students and I did was we put together all of the research literature that was relevant to it, showing that some people do have a sense of entitlement because they're men, or else they're male-identified women, that many people, whether they're women or men, feel they're entitled to the services of women, feel that women are inferior, have a great deal of trouble expressing a range of feelings, all of those things. So we sent in all of the supporting research, and they just ignored us. They didn't even write back and say, we're reviewing it. That was it. They just ignored it.
Describe ways in which the media ignores or distorts important aspects of the struggle of challenging the DSM.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I wrote They Say You're Crazy, I decided I wanted to do a whole chapter on that particular subject, because the chapter is focused on what happened with the media and the premenstrual dysphoric disorder category in particular. And I chose that one because there was a lot of activity around that, and because I had done a lot of media interviews myself. Therefore, I was in a position to know what information I had given the media, what claims I had made, what evidence I gave to back them up, and then I could look at what did they write, what did they broadcast. And there's a very detailed table in the book that shows who said what. And sadly, the vast majority of media people really sort of functioned as though they were press agents for the American Psychiatric Association. It was quite appalling. For example, they would use terminology like this. They would say, Kaplan claims such and such. And they would say, but the DSM people explained that, right? And there were only two really terrific pieces that covered this accurately. And one was by Michelle Landsberg, you know, the columnist, former columnist for the Toronto Star, who just did a brilliant job. And the other was a woman who wrote for the Boston Globe, whose name I can't recall right now, but it was all too rare to have that covered accurately. And it's still happening. It's still happening with media coverage.
What do you think some of the biggest myths that are perpetuated by the media about all of this? Not just the particular struggle, but about mental health and diagnoses and the whole psychiatric pharmaceutical complex? Mm. Oh, that's a big question.
That's an excellent question. I think one of the biggest myths perpetuated by the media is that the psychiatric, pardon me, let me start over. I think one of the biggest myths perpetuated by the media is that the psychiatric establishment, and that goes for psychological as well, and the drug companies really do know best, that their main interests are in helping people who are suffering. And that's just not true. There are some individuals in those systems and in government who really do care. But the vast majority are so caught up in the whole medicalized way of thinking about this and this obsession with psychiatric diagnosis. Let's find the label for this person so we don't have to really get to know them. that they really do an awful lot of harm.
Where is the harm in labeling people with disorders?
One thing is that you see them as their label instead of as a person. And that's not just a kind of wishy-washy sentimental concern. It's that when somebody comes to see me, if what I do is I get out my DSM and I spend most of my time with them trying to figure out which label do they match the most closely, then there are all kinds of questions I won't ask, things I won't get to know about their lives. And if you're going to be able to help someone, you can be much more effective by really getting to know everything you can about them instead of which criteria do they meet from the manual. And also, and even teachers who work with kids who have learning problems know you want to know what their weaknesses are, but you also want to know what strengths they have that you can build on. So you don't learn that stuff if you just go by the DSM.
You wrote in They Say You're Crazy, quote, "I believe that for too many people who are badly treated because of their race, sex, age, class, sexual orientation, mental or physical condition, physical appearance, and so on, end up seeking psychotherapy because they mistakenly believe that their unhappiness stems from something within themselves." You go on to say, "Too much contemporary treatment influenced by the DSM maintains this almost exclusive focus on individuals' psyches as if the major sources of their troubles come from within them."
That's right.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, yeah, that's one reason that it's so worrying when the media don't question this, don't even ask questions that are based on the assumption that maybe if you got a psychiatric label, something happened to you other than this internal sort of craziness, and that's individual to you. What happens then is that supposing you are the target of all kinds of racist epithets, and of course that's depressing, of course it's frightening, of course it makes you agitated. If you're suffering and you want to feel better, if you go to a therapist about this, then they're going to give you a psychiatric label, almost definitely, certainly if insurance is going to cover the therapy. And so you may have gone in there with one problem or one set of problems. You come out and you got another one, which is, "And I'm mentally ill." And it also, as I mentioned before, it means that getting a diagnostic label, just about any diagnostic label, perpetuates the notion that the problem comes from within you. So it masks all sorts of social problems and economic problems that need to be looked at if we're going to reduce people's pain.
For people who are concerned and affected by this, what can people do about this monstrosity that seems to be set totally against us?
Well, people can do a number of things. One is make sure that you remind yourself all the time and teach other people that psychiatric diagnosis and psychiatric treatment, for the most part, has very little science involved. So don't assume that when you hear therapists talking or when you hear drug company advertisements that you're hearing the truth, that there's anything objective about this. A second thing, keep in mind and tell other people this, that often people who turn to the mental health system for help, and after all, you only go there because you're suffering already, end up getting harmed. They may be helped in some ways and harmed in other ways, or they may just be harmed. Sometimes people will just be helped, but that's much too rare an occurrence for most people's liking. Another thing is, when you see someone that you think is unusual, don't assume they're crazy. Don't assume they are utterly different from you. Assume that there's some reason that they are acting in a way that you think is strange or that makes you uncomfortable. And look for the common humanity between you. Let me give you just one quick example that we can end on. A woman came to see me last week, and she walked in. I'd never met her before, and I immediately kind of wanted to pull back from her because she was very, very tense. She looked, her eyes were kind of rolling around, and she, her face was not very expressive. And I said, well, can you tell me what brings you here? And so she started talking about the razor's edge, that things, everything's too loud, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I know what people would say. She's hallucinating, she's hearing voices, this woman is really crazy, and maybe I should send her to somebody with an MD who can put her on medication. And I thought, wait a minute, I've known people who were considered weird, and I knew them well, and I knew they were not mentally ill. They were just unusual. And sometimes when someone starts out with quirks or something that's a little different, people treat them strangely. So then they react more strangely. Then people treat them even more strangely. So you get this snowball effect. And then they end up so different from most other people that people think they're crazy. So what I did was I, instead of thinking, oh, hallucinations, she said razor's edge and everything's loud and so on, I said, tell me what you mean. I want to understand what you mean. And what came out was that she was extremely lonely, extremely sad. She was telling me a story about how everybody in her family had, basically they were scapegoating her. There were a lot of problems in the family. But because she was the one who would speak the truth and say, hey, look what's going on, everybody was scared of her. So they said, you're a loser, you're no good, you're a troublemaker. And she just felt completely alone and could not bear it. And didn't want to think about it because she thought, I will start crying, and if I start crying, I'll never stop. So there she was with these intense, powerful, horrible feelings, but trying not to feel them. And so everything that happened was overwhelming to her. As she told me this, her expressions became more animated, her facial muscles relaxed. If somebody had walked in then, she wouldn't have looked weird to them. And I found myself liking her better and being able to connect with her. And I was thinking, boy, you know, I didn't really think this was going to work, but I'm glad I started by assuming that she and I were more alike than not alike. But that's not what I was trained to do in my graduate school, and it's not what most people learn to do about somebody, you know, that you meet on the street or on the bus who seems strange to you.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, and I'd like to thank you for joining us. Any parting words?
Well, thank you. Your questions were wonderful. It was a pleasure to do this. Nice to talk to good media people.